Your Health is supported by the North Carolina Cancer Hospital, serving you with innovative research with unequaled care. UNC Healthcare is leading, teaching, caring.
News Talk 1360, WCHL, and UNC Family Medicine present Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Your Health, providing practical health-related news and information for our listeners. Dr. Goldstein and Dr. Page are both actively involved in patient care at UNC Family Medicine. Now, Your Health.
Welcome to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health, supported by UNC Healthcare. I'm Dr. Christy Page.
And I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein.
On our show today, Adam and I are going to be talking with the founder of HealthyMe Weight Loss Program and Overall Health Program, Dr. Guy Rackmuth, about using cell phones to improve your health.
And health, Adam, HealthyMe, the letter E, the letter me.
Me. I'm so excited to have this conversation, Adam. Really, it's like the future is now. You dreamed that maybe you could get these health, healthy behaviors linked to a cell phone. That just seems...
Well, and we've been covering research about cell phones and brain cancer and other bad things and aggression and all these things that, playing video games. But here, this is really making an impact on helping people lose weight, quit smoking. Mm-hmm. And we're going to really be talking with one of the entrepreneurs in this region about this. So very, very exciting. But first, Christy, we also have some exciting research that matters this week, ranging from looking at mental health hospitalization for young children.
Looking at blood clot risks on the contraceptive pill, at advertising for junk food to children.
And then back to mental health and looking at the question of public policy. Should North Carolina compensate, as the very first state in the country, those who were sterilized against their will back in the 1940s to 1960s?
Gives me a pit in my stomach. Let's do the other stuff first.
Well, these are hard topics today.
They are.
The very first one is research about young children hospitalized for mental illness in the United States. And this was research that was in the Archives of General Psychiatry.
And unfortunately, it's not great news, at least on the surface, that during this period of 1996 to 2007, the rate of hospitalizations in psychiatric hospitals for children, that rate rose more than 80% for 15 to 13-year-olds and by 42% for older teenagers. So more kids are being hospitalized for mental illness than they were in the past.
Yeah, and we know that it's far better if we can treat particularly teenagers in the outpatient setting rather than having to resort to hospitalization, because hospitalization is just another huge step forward, and these teens get removed from their normal environment and removed from school, and there's all kinds of potential issues. But yet we have to assume that for the great majority of these admissions, these were necessary, and so it makes us take pause and stop and say, what were the diagnoses and what can we learn and what can we do?
And there have been efforts to make outpatient treatment more available. And what's not working about that? Are we really having more mental illness among these kids? And I mean, there's so many questions that this raises that I look forward to people researching further so we can take care of people.
They did discover that the diagnosis that had the most increase was bipolar disorder, or sometimes called manic depressive, a mood disorder that I think we're more in tune with, that may have happened as much in the past, but we're more in tune with it now. Maybe this is not all bad because we're diagnosing it and treating it better, and ultimately maybe reducing the types of behavior that can lead to hospitalizations, which are most frequently going to be aggression, mm-hmm. volatility, threats,
or suicidality.
Suicidality. So maybe these hospitalizations can reduce those things, and that's not a bad thing. What's the take-home message here, Christy, for parents and teens that you'd be recommending from this research?
Well, I recommend to all parents to really watch out for mental illness, for substance abuse, and for any signs that your child is suffering, and to get treatment early. And then that we need to work within our mental health system. We certainly have some improvement to do in our own state to make sure that the children are getting services they need before it comes to that point. And if they need to be hospitalized for safety, then it's not necessarily a bad thing, but we need to ask those questions.
Aggression, not a normal thing for a teenager in most settings. And if you as a parent are worried, please bring it to your primary care doctor. Let us help. What's our very next research that matters?
Okay. Well, this raises a lot of questions, too. This is about a vein problem called stenosis or stiffening of the left side of the veins on one side of the leg that can raise a risk for getting a clot if you're on the birth control pill.
And this was one of those research articles, Christy, that I think you looked at and I looked at and we went, huh? Really?
What?
I mean, this was in a major journal, American Journal of Obstetrics and Gynecology, and this looks at the risk of a clot, a deep vein thrombosis, a clot in these veins in women who both have this abnormality of this vein, maybe genetically a narrowed vein, with the combination of the birth control pill. What did they find?
Well, they found that the folks, they had 35 women who had the stenosis and 35 women who didn't to compare them to. And they found the ones who had the stiff vein, it raised their clot risk, their risk of getting a deep clot 3.5 times. And if they were on oral contraceptives, that raised it nearly 5 times. If they were on both, if they had both the stenosis and were on birth control pills, it raised the risk by 17.7 times.
Right, so we call that a multiplication factor. It's not just 1 plus 1 equals 2 here. It's when you have both these things together, it multiplies into a much greater risk factor. This caught my attention, Christy. And you, I know when we were thinking about this show and this article, you said, well, Adam, what do I do about all these women? I'm giving birth control pills every day. Do I need to start doing ultrasounds and looking for this abnormality? And
well, I would have assumed that it was rare. I mean, we talk about, do you smoke? Do you have any family history of a blood clot? Those are pretty standard things. But this study suggested that the stenosis might be more common, might be up to 25%. And if that's the case, then we need to consider that in a lot more depth. So this is early research. I think it needs further explanation, exploration. I'm currently not, I don't know anyone who is doing routine ultrasounds on every patient before birth control, but it's worth finding out.
Certainly, if you have any sort of heightened risk factors, this would be something else to consider. And if you get swelling in the left side of your leg after starting birth control pills, please see your doctor and get ultrasound to see if this clot's there. What's our very next research that matters?
Our next one is on advertising junk food. So we know that a third of children in the United States are overweight or obese, and yet companies who have pledged that they won't try to advertise unhealthy food to kids are finding ways to do that.
Yep. This is insidious, really. We used to see this with tobacco and alcohol products in movies and on TV. Now we see it. I was just at the movie with my daughter the other night, Christy, and I saw a commercial. I saw Coca-Cola products being advertised in the movie. How do they advertise? Well, the product placements, and none of that occurs by chance.
If someone just happens to be drinking a Coca-Cola or on American Idol or something like that.
That's right. So, you can read about this research, but common sense dictates if you see these product placements, what I'd recommend to parents, Christy, is mention it to your child. Say, this is actually a paid advertisement for this particular product. What do you think? So that they don't just kind of blindly, because they see these actually even more than they do the regular paid advertisements that occur before and after the TV shows and the movies.
Good point. Okay, the last one is harder than we have time to talk about, but this is about whether or not we should, as a state, pay for mental health services for the people who were forcibly sterilized between 1929 and 1974 who are still alive.
Well, it's not even just mental health services. It's really compensation here, which assumingly that it would be for their trauma, but it could be both physical and mental suffering. But North Carolina is the very first state that's really considering a form of restitution to compensation of these. And, they're talking about $20,000 to $50,000, $40 to $50 million is what it would cost. There are thousands of still living survivors of these that occurred up until the late 1960s. Hard to believe, Christy.
Well, it's hard for me to believe that in our state that we were like big promoters of eugenics, of believing that people who didn't have good genes or who might have some mental health problems or all kinds of excuses that we could just take away their ability to have children and that was okay. And so now all these years later, it's just it's hard to figure out how to reconcile that.
Well, and it used to be that this was done more predominantly among white women, but then it became among African-American women, American Indians, the poor, undereducated, those who are disabled. this is really an issue that I think the state should find the money. I think North Carolina could be a leader in the country. I would encourage our listeners to call their legislators and to voice support for this particular issue. I think it's the right thing to do. I don't know. Any other thoughts, Christy?
Well, I think we need some sort of reconciliation. So I'm really proud that as a state, we are actually having a task force, owning up to it, having this discussion,
and
even all
these
years later.
Let's do a whole show on this. Let's get a guest on here,
That'd be great, Adam.
Really talk about this in much more detail. Well, that's probably conclude the research that matters. We've talked about policy and sterilization.
We've talked a little bit about product placements and advertisement of junk food
about
to our kids.
If you get swelling in your left leg and you're on a birth control pill, think about possible risk factors.
And an increase in hospitalizations for our teens with mental illness. That does conclude the Research That Matters portion of the show. When we come back, we'll be talking with Dr. Guy Rackmuth about using cell phones to improve your health. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on News Talk 1360 WCHL, sponsored by UNC Family Medicine. And now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Today on Conversations, we're talking with Dr. Guy Rackmuth about really using cell phones to improve your health. This is a topic Christy and I are really interested in. Looking at ways that we can advance people's health without necessarily using drugs or having side effects. And so we're really pleased to have Dr. Rackmuth with us today. Dr. Rackmuth graduated from Harvard University with a PhD in biomedical engineering focused on neuroplasticity. And he, along with his wife, have formed a new company here in North Carolina called Healthy Me, a weight loss program, a behavior change program, and we look forward to really hearing about that as we go along. But welcome to our show.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks for being with us, Dr. Rackmuth. Tell us how you became interested enough in technology and health and lifestyle change that you would head forth and make a business.
Well, I've always been interested in health. My passion is looking at Star Trek and seeing the tricorder that they used to have, and I said, "Hey,
the what?
The tricorder, the thing that they scan people with."
Oh, you mean was it the doctor
Spock?
No.
The other doctor.
Yeah. Okay, the doctor who scanned people.
Exactly.
Right,
and I said, you know, I wonder if we can miniaturize some of these things and actually help people improve their health with technology. So that I spent my whole years in school studying biomedical engineering. So I've always been interested in medicine, but no offense, never wanted to be a physician. I wanted to contribute in different ways.
Well, actually, the biomedical engineering program at the University of North Carolina is part of the School of Medicine and is very well known, nationally known. Just briefly, what is biomedical engineering for our listeners?
Biomedical engineering is basically applying engineering concepts, like systems, and understanding the human body in terms of systems, and then trying to understand how you can take in mechanical and electronic components to try to interact with the human body as a system. So, for example, eyeglasses is essentially an optical mechanism. An EKG is an electrical system that actually records your heart signals. And all those things electrical engineers come up with. I mean, it spans anywhere from genetics all the way to building big MRI machines, whole body scanners.
How do we get from that, thinking about those systems and body mechanics, to lifestyle choices that people make and their overall health? Where'd you make that leap?
Well, I studied neuroscience doing my PhD work at Harvard, and I focused in on how the brain modifies in response to new experiences and then mimicking those processes on an artificial platform. So I designed this microchip, think an Intel chip, that mimics how neurons connect and speak with each other. So the idea was, hey, can we replace Parkinson's disease, take pathological tissue and insert a chip to act as a bridge? And so I actually really have a passion for how the brain gets modified in response to new environments, new stimuli, and new experiences. So I took that, and my co-founder, Sloan, is a media psychologist, but she's also been in healthcare for a very, very long time, and from a very practical perspective, has sat across the table, much like you guys have, from people trying to get them to change their behaviors. And there are elements where a whole person changes in a different way compared to how the brain actually acts on a cellular level. So we try to combine those two aspects together to create an artificial intelligence that helps people manage, drives people to change their behaviors.
Well, you know, Christy and I have been talking for a long time on your health about the lifestyle interventions of weight loss for people who are overweight, physical activity for people who are physically inactive, smoking cessation, cutting down on alcohol use when you're abusing it, the types of things that really could eliminate 90% of preventable causes of death. But these are all behavioral changes. People have to change their behavior. And if it were easy, it seems like people would have done it. Why is changing behavior, from your perspective and your wife's perspective, what do we know why it's so difficult?
Well, we look at different behaviors as a form of addiction. So with smoking and alcohol, we know that it acts on receptors in the brain. With food and exercise, those are less well understood in terms of how they physically affect the physical brain in terms of receptors released and so on. What's difficult about behavior change is that people, by and large, don't want to change. People, by and large, like the way they set their lives up. I mean, I heard a...
Well, wait. When you say they don't want to change, I mean, if we ask our patients, do you want to lose weight, I would venture to say almost every one of our overweight patients would say, yeah, I want to lose weight. If you ask people who smoke, do you want to quit? Yeah. What it gets down to is, would you want to quit today? Well, no, not today.
Right.
Or when it's, do you want to eat this meal or do you want to not have that cigarette you're craving? Those are different decisions than the global ones.
No, that's right. Those are.
So is there this part of the brain that says, yeah, I want to, but I really don't want to? How does that work?
I mean, I think there's a lot of research into health economics and how people value present rewards compared to future rewards.
Mm-hmm.
And that's very, very interesting research. But what we see is that people, by and large, act as if what matters to them today is enjoyment. And so,
give us an example. Can you come to mind?
So, for example, we saw a story about a lady who's diabetic, and she knows she's diabetic, and she's like, diabetes is ruining my eyesight, and I have huge ulcers. And then a friend of hers calls her on the phone, and she says, please get me a cheesecake and some fried chicken because I can't stand it. You know, so she completely doesn't connect her diabetes with the fact that she's making very poor choices. And that's something that people don't understand. They forget what they're supposed to do on a daily basis because it's easy to default back into the old behaviors. And that's what Healthy Me is actually trying to do, is to stay in their face and make sure that they remember on a daily basis, just like anything else, how to make those new behaviors stick.
So, I mean, one of the things about lifestyle choices, and we're all acknowledging that they're really hard. It's hard to get up off the couch and go exercise, or it's hard to make those choices. And the studies that I've read suggest that doctors talking with their patients about this, depending on the behavior, may or may not be all that effective. What do we know from the research that does work to get people to make those choices?
Well, we know that when physicians bring up weight loss with their patients, over 90% of them try to do something, which is shocking.
That's encouraging.
Very, very positive. But in the same research study said that only 40% of patients actually hear it from their physician. So the first step is to get physicians to bring it up with their patients and not be fearful. Not fearful, of course not, but not be
hesitant.
Hesitant to
talk about it.
Right. And we recognize that physicians, people go see their physicians for a particular reason, and it's almost not the most important reason during that visit. So there's plenty of research that says if a physician brings it up and says, listen, Mary Jo, you're 40 pounds overweight, you're on 5 medications, you have to do something. Where something fails and why we actually created Healthy Me is the best thing that physicians can say is, I can set you up with a nutritionist. Or, you know, I really want you to eat some more fruits and vegetables. Go hit the gym and I'll see you back in 6 months. There's really no way to stay on the patient. And mm-hmm. So what happens is, even if they go to a meeting for an hour with a nutritionist, half hour later, most of that stuff is forgotten. And so what we know...
Because you mentioned enjoyment. You said that part of this whole aspect is enjoyment. Well, as physicians, we don't focus on enjoyment in our patients' lives. A lot of what we do is curing disease and sometimes using drugs that sometimes don't make people feel so well even on their path to getting better. So you're having to deal with this instant sort of feedback.
That's right. Exactly. You know, some of the biggest reasons that people don't take their some of their medication is perceived weight gain, you know, increase in sleepiness. So most people don't care. Yes, I agree with you that 100% of your patients, if you ask them if they want to lose weight, would say yes. But by and large, day to day, what people care about is having energy during the day and being able to sleep well at night. And by not focusing on pure weight loss, which becomes a chore, you're able to modify their behavior across a variety of conditions, including improving their mood and improving their sleep habits.
So by choosing foods and that are healthy, they may actually feel better during the day and helping them reframe that. That's sounds like there's a lot of power in your message there. We do need to take a short break, but when we come back, we'll continue talking with our guest, Dr. Guy Rackmuth, about Healthy Me and using smartphones and cell phones to improve your health. Stay with us. We'll be right back with Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Your Health is supported by UNC Health Sciences Library and NC Health Info, working together to connect people everywhere with knowledge to improve health. Visit nchealthinfo.org for answers you can trust.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on WCHL. And now, back to the show.
Welcome back. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. We've been talking with Dr. Guy Rackmuth about using cell phones to improve your health. And specifically, Dr. Rackmuth, we've been talking about the difficulty of helping people make healthy choices and reframing that in a positive way. But we want to hear more specifically about your program, Healthy Me, and how it works to help our patients do this.
Yeah, tell us a little bit about it. What struck our attention was there was a press release in the newspaper we saw about a program you're doing in Blue Cross Blue Shield to help maybe thousands of their patients. Obesity is one of the key sentinel problems that we deal with, and clinically it's relevant to so many patients. You're dealing with it now directly on the front lines. What's happening?
So it's actually really interesting. We viewed physicians and insurance companies are some of the most important allies in this battle for obesity. They're the ones who care the most. And what happens is that we go to physicians or to a payer and ask them to give us their patients. And specifically, what we're able to do is custom tailor. We combine clinical interventions with motivational psychology. And then our secret sauce is an artificial intelligence engine.
Okay, you're going to have to translate those three things. Well, I know from the biomedical engineering in simple terms.
Right. So, you know, we take clinically validated diets and exercise plans, things that have been studied for the last 30 to 40 years, things like the DASH diet, dietary approaches to stipe hypertension, consistent carbohydrate diet, and the Mediterranean diet, for example.
Things that we recommend to our patients, right?
Yes.
Okay.
Exactly. We then take, for example, for exercise, we take the 10,000 steps plan and then the 150-minute per week plan that the ACSM, the American College of Sports Medicine, recommends for patients. So, again, we take clinically validated approaches.
Evidence-based things that we know work.
Uh-huh. We then break them down into manageable pieces, essentially a text message-based intervention.
And text message.
Exactly.
So it comes on the cell phone.
On the phone every day, at least once, if not twice a day, at the most opportune time in order to induce behavior change. How do we know the most opportune time? I'm glad you asked.
For me, it's between them.
We know, for example, that people eat at night. We might send them
their
a text.
Biggest meal.
Not just the biggest meal, but people tend to snack at night.
Right.
So what happens is that they come from work and they're starving. So they have their meal at 6 or 7, and then they sit in front of the TV and they work. Watch TV and graze a little bit. We send a text message at 9 o'clock that says, hey, I know you're in front of the TV. I want you to get up, get to the wall, and give us 10 push-ups over the next commercial break, for example. Now,
wow.
That's not going to work for every person. How do we know which person it's going to work for? Well, as the person comes into the program, they fill out essentially an intake form, which takes no more than 2 to 3 minutes. But that intake form gives us their behavioral DNA, if you will, the way they're wired to receive information. So there are different kinds of people who respond to different kinds of messages, and that's what Healthy Meat does.
Can you give us an example of who would respond to a different type of message?
Absolutely. So let me give you an example of a lady named Marsha. We know Marsha likes black beans because she has tracked on our Healthy Meat site that she, you know, a variety of her meals over the past month or so. Marsha is somebody who likes to be compared to the mean. She requires people around her to be very supportive. There are some people who are not like that. Some people are very self-driven, but some people really like to have that environment of support. So Wilson, and Marsha's goal is to reduce her cholesterol. That's what her physician said. And so she's on the DASH diet, or the Mediterranean diet, where she needs to eat 25 grams of fiber, for example. So we'll send her a text message that says, "Hey, Marsha, we know you're on a DASH diet and your goal is to get 25 grams of fiber. We know you love black beans. A cup of black beans already has 15 grams of fiber. So go have some today." So what we're doing there is we're targeting her by saying, "We know what you like to eat. We know that it's something that's important to you and to your physician, and we thereby lower the barrier for her to actually perform that behavior."
What about the interactive piece? Where does that come from? So, because I assume I might say, I'm heading out to eat tonight with my family, and we're going to a place that doesn't serve black beans.
No, that's right. So those are things that we're not set up to do yet. But what we do help with is focusing on very small behaviors like eating more fruits and vegetables, drinking more water, and taking more steps. Remember, our average patient is BMI of 34. We have
body mass index.
Body mass index, which
that's
means
obese.
That's obese. Yeah,
that's not
level
overweight.
Two obese.
That's obese and close to morbidly obese.
That's right. Over almost 100 pounds overweight. So most of our people are not your athletes. By definition, they're not necessarily hitting the gym and they're not necessarily eating healthy. So all we're focusing on is very small behaviors. So we'll send her a message at 6 o'clock. Say, "Hey, Marsha, how many steps have you taken today?" And she texts us back, I don't know, 5,900, because she has a pedometer from Healthy Me. We text her back and say, "Hey, great job on 5964. But guess what? Everybody else is around 6,500. It's only 6 o'clock, so you still have time. Go take another lap around the
positive
block."
Positive reinforcement.
Yes.
So there you see, we do positive reinforcement because we know that's what she responds to. Some people you can beat up, say, "Come on, 5964. Come on, you got to get to 10,000. But that's not Marsha. Marsha needs positive reinforcements and she needs to be compared to the mean. So we compared her to the rest of her colleagues and then we again lowered the barrier by saying, "It's only 6 o'clock. Go take a lap around the block twice."
So I hear this, and of course, it makes sense that this would work. You're tailoring it to the individual, and you're using the psychology to tailor it for that specific person's approach to life.
Exactly.
How do you know that this truly works in terms of helping them truly lose weight?
That's a great question. So I'll tell you, we've had over 1,100 people on the program so far. Out of those 1,100, 900 of them have been on the program for 3 months. On average, our users lose 8% of their body weight in 3 months and close to 11 or even 12% at 6 months. So the end at 6 months is slightly lower. So those are all self-reported, but at the same time, we send reports back to their physicians. And so there is some level of verification and some ability to verify that weight loss is true. Wow. We are essentially double what every other weight loss program, I'm very proud of this, we're double what every other online weight loss program is able to achieve. And the reason is because we get people to engage with us over a very long period of time. Most people lose interest in weight loss after 5 to 10 weeks. People stay with us for almost a year.
Let's talk a little bit about the cost and how you structure this.
I
know you're an entrepreneur as well, and this sounds great and wonderful. I sent you some data. We talked recently about some positive reports of text messaging, helping people quit smoking successfully. So we know that it can work. Is it affordable and sustainable for people? How is that going to work?
No, it's a great question. So we price the program. It's a 3-month program. It's $49, which is about $16 per month. Now, that's on average very similar to what you see in the marketplace. We truly believe that a person has to have some skin in the game in order for them to truly engage in the program. So somebody has to want to change. Although we consider ourselves social entrepreneurs, we do believe, like I said, that this is something that somebody has to pay for. We've had very positive response to that price point. That is rarely the issue.
What about for teenagers? Teenage obesity is such a problem, but who pays for that, and do you accept those in your program?
That's a huge problem. I know that some hospital systems have it in their charter to help kids over a particular locality. We are currently piloting ages between 14 and 18. We do not want to go under the age of 14. So far, up until this point, we've only really accepted adults for a variety of reasons. We wanted to make sure that the program actually works. But if we can reach those teens earlier in their lives, we're hoping to have a really large impact on their lives.
Well, I know we're going to have to wrap up in a second, but I know you actually mentioned to us before you came on that you have an offer for Your Health listeners who this may be appropriate for. To engage with the program, and it sounds like a potential win-win. Tell us about what the offer is, and what the types of feedback that people can really benefit from if they choose to involve. And Christy and I think any efforts that can improve people's health that isn't overly costly. This doesn't appear to me to be overly costly. Is a good thing. So it certainly would have
my
backing, and we're supporters. So tell us how it works. What can people do?
Well, thank you very much. For Your Health listeners, please go to www.myhealtheme.com. So it's the letter E in the middle, and then on the coupon code, it'll ask you a couple of questions. Type in Your Health, and that should give you a first month free on the 3-month program.
But we'll put that on our website because it sounds like a wonderful opportunity, and it for people who want to lose weight. Any other people that it would be appropriate to explore this program?
Absolutely. We've seen a lot of people respond to stress management, improve their mood, as well as just overall health. We've had 91% of our users tell us that they've drink more water since they've been on Healthy Me, and 60% feel healthier.
People who are diabetic and maybe need to have a better diet, people who need to exercise more, are those also appropriate or not?
Absolutely. High blood pressure, sleep apnea, low back pain, we help with some of those as well. Anything that really requires you to change your behavior, but you're just at your wit's ends, we're here to help.
Fantastic.
Well,
Thank you.
We've been talking with Dr. Guy Rackmuth about Healthy Me and the use of the cell phone, which everyone has sometimes two of. They can use one of them to exercise more and one of them to lose weight here. Thank you so much for being with us. Maybe you'll come back sometime and let us know how things are working.
Thank you very much for having me.
Coming up on House Calls, we're going to be answering questions about your health. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on News Talk 1360 WCHL, sponsored by UNC Family Medicine. And now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back to Your Health. For the House Call segment of our show today, Adam and I are going to spend a few minutes talking about your health questions and concerns.
And if you have some things you would like us to address, send them to us at yourhealth@unc.edu. And Christy, we have some excellent questions today about diet and side effects from medications and x-rays and just common things like sports. Listen to our very first question about heart disease carbohydrates.
Hey, this is Reed Johnson. I've been wondering what contributes more to heart disease, carbohydrates or cholesterol. I wanted to know what you guys thought.
That's a great question. You know, and I thought, I know the answer to this. And then I thought, well, maybe I don't know the answer to this. And I had to look it up a little bit.
Well, it's funny. I thought, I don't know the answer to that. And then immediately I thought, yes, I do. We came at this from different angles. But this is confusing since there's so much focus on different diets, fad diets, some diets that are, you know, carbohydrates are evil and some that, focus on no cholesterol. And it is very confusing. I commend you for trying to pay attention and make healthy choices.
And the reason that this is a really good question is because, you know, a lot of people will try to lose weight, for instance, and they'll try to go on low cholesterol, low fat diets, and then others will try diets that are low in carbohydrates. And you're really kind of doing two different things there, because with the low fat diet, you might lower your cholesterol, but you might substitute high carbohydrate foods, and that might be bad for you because of what it does to your insulin. On the other hand, you could be having the low carbohydrate foods but having high amounts of cholesterol in your diet. So I guess it's probably not an either-or question.
It's not either. And from my point of view, I think you should think about big picture factors that can affect your risk for heart disease. So your genetics you can't change, but you can not smoke. Your age you can't change, but you can control your weight. And so a healthy diet where you're exercising and you're keeping control over your weight is going to be a very positive step towards reducing your risk for heart disease.
And I guess one other, a slightly different perspective is that I do think that we don't pay enough attention perhaps to having lower carbohydrates. And in portion, thinking about the glycemic index and the glycemic load as the complexity of those carbohydrates. And a lower glycemic index and a lower glycemic load means that the volume, the amount of carbohydrates you have and the types of them are the most beneficial. And we're going to put something on our website, maybe keep it up there for a while, about the glycemic index. There's a great website about that and some information about the types of foods. You know, we talked about potatoes really having a high glycemic index, and people eat a lot of them at a time, so they get a very large glycemic load versus things like fruit punch. Orange juice. It gets a very low glycemic load. And so there's really different how your body can process these, but we're going to probably pay a little bit more attention, but pay attention to both of things, both low cholesterol and low carbohydrates.
And consider talking with your family doctor or a nutritionist about how to tailor it for you and your life and your medical situation. Let's take our next question.
Hi, my name is Leslie Bates, and I have a quick question. I was given a prescription for Ambien from my doctor, and when I went to fill my order, the pharmacist lets me know of all of these side effects. So my question is, whose advice should I follow, the doctor or the pharmacist?
Another really good question. And, you know, it struck me as I heard this that, you know, all meds have potential side effects. And the pharmacist has to kind of review these with each patient. And they should review them. And honestly, the physicians should be reviewing the potential side effects. And so in this, it sounds to me, I may be reading between the lines, but that your doctor prescribed a medicine for not sleeping well, and that then you got to the pharmacist and they went over all the side effects and it got confusing.
Yeah, and I'm not so certain the pharmacist told you not to take the medicine here.
Right.
You know, what I'm going to tell patients, I don't know how you, Christy, but I'll say, you know, listen, any drug we give, and most natural drugs as well, have hundreds of side effects. And I'm going to tell you what the top three or four that people can really experience, in my opinion, but read about all of them. And if you experience anything yourself that's not natural for you, then it may not be the right drug for you.
If the side effects are concerning, go back to your doctor, talk to the doctor. The doctor says, hey, it's safe to try it and see if you have any of these side effects. Then, you know, you have to have that relationship and that conversation with the doctor who's prescribing the medicine. So the doctor and the pharmacist are trying to work together, but in this case, it sounds like you feel divided. So good luck talking to your doctor.
So the pharmacist is right and the doctor is right.
That's right, both. Okay.
What's our very next house call question?
When you have cluster headaches and you've had an MRI several years ago, like 7 years ago, when is the next time you need to get another MRI?
That's a good question. And, you know, again, depends on the situation and your exact symptoms. But most people who have headaches don't get a scan of their head or an MRI of their head if they're not having any other concerning symptoms, or it's if they're responding to medications and that sort of thing. If you have a normal exam, and so most people might not even get that initial scan, but for you, you got an MRI, and I hope that sounds like it was okay. And the question is, should you get another one down the road?
Yeah, sometimes we actually see it the other extreme. It's been you've gotten one MRI a year because you show up in the emergency room with a headache, and they get an MRI quickly. And so, like every 7 years, you probably should get a break. You know, it's like a sabbatical. You can not have the MRI this year. You know, unless your symptoms really have changed, the pattern of your headaches is getting so much worse, and really something's changing in them that makes you and your doctor concerned, that's when you maybe need to have it reevaluated.
I would agree with that. Let's take our last house call question.
Hi, my name's Philip Cook, and I'm a UNC student. I like to play sports a lot, and every now and then I'll get pain in my joints. And I would like to wonder, what's the best pain reliever, and what's a recommended dosage for an adult male?
Well, congratulations here. First off, congratulations, you're a UNC student. Wise choice.
And that you're exercising and playing sports. So briefly, there are some changes in Tylenol dosing. If you took 500 milligrams or less about every 4 hours, 4 to 6 hours as you need it, that's a pretty standard dose. And then Motrin or ibuprofen or Aleve, they're all about the same. You could take 600 or 800 milligrams 3 times a day with food. Don't tear up your belly, so be careful with that dose. That's a doctor dose.
So if you're a student, you know, and you're getting pain in your joints after exercise, my advice is maybe you're doing something a little bit unusual, because young people shouldn't get that much pain in their joints. And so, you know, maybe you're overdoing it. Maybe you need to rest. Maybe you need to work with a physical therapist here. It's easy to get the medications, and I take them a lot when I'm really out of sorts here. But maybe altering what you're doing a little bit here may be in order too.
Good point, Adam. Okay, well, we've had a little bit of time to talk about pain with exercise, about headaches and MRIs,
about the pharmacist and you, or maybe right about side effects from the medicines, and about low cholesterol and low carbohydrate diets.
So that is all we'll have time for today, but thank you for asking your questions. We want to encourage folks to send us your questions. You can email us at yourhealth@unc.edu.
Where can they go online?
Yourhealthradio.org.
They can follow us also on
Twitter, Facebook, and
iTunes, as well as free
podcasts.
So lots of ways to follow us, and we want you to join us. And we want to also thank WCHL, UNC Family Medicine, UNC Healthcare for their sponsorship, and our great guest today, Dr. Guy Rackmuth.
We hope you'll join us next time on Your Health. I'm Dr. Christy Page.
And I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein. We'll see you again next week.
Bye-bye.
The purpose of Your Health Radio is to educate listeners on healthcare issues. Listeners should always discuss their own health or medical concerns with their personal physician or other healthcare provider. Your Health is not a substitute for medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page has been brought to you by UNC Family Medicine for the Chapel Hill Carborough community. You can hear Your Health on Saturdays at 9 a.m., Sundays at 9 and 5, and Mondays at 6 and 10 p.m. Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of UNC Family Medicine and News Talk 1360, WCHL.